Blog Talk Radio.
Dan mentioned how NATO have been targeting the
over 100,000 soldiers in Libya, but there were also thousands of ordinary men and women. There were a lot of women who volunteered since the beginning of the crisis to defend their country, and they were armed by the government. And during that week in Tripoli when the fighting began, I witnessed how ordinary men and women took up the weapons that they had been trained to use during that 6 months to defend their country. And so I'm going to, as a journalist, I'm going to talk a little bit about the role of the media. And this has been an incredible media war. Dan alluded strongly to the criminalization of the Libyan government and Gaddafi. So they said the media were about to be killed in Benghazi, but they never showed us any evidence. They said that 6,000 people had been killed by the government. Rights organizations have confirmed that approximately 250 have died from both sides. They said that the Libyan government was attacking its own people from the air, and Russian intelligence satellites have since shown us that this was impossible. They said that the government was hiring mercenaries from elsewhere in Africa. They never showed us the evidence. Instead, we saw the videos of black Libyans and other black Africans being lynched in public squares by NATO's ground troops, the rebels, with scores of people filming on their mobile phones and Western special forces looking on. They said that Gaddafi was hated by his people, but they never showed us the 1.7 million people in a country of 6 million in Green Square on July the 1st. All the masses in Talhuna, in Sabha, in Beni Wali, in Sirte, and across the country who demonstrated to pledge their allegiance to their leader and to the Jamahiriya. They never showed us the masses, as I said, of ordinary men and women who had accepted the government's offer of weapons to defend their families, neighborhoods, and country from people who wished to condemn them to enslavement, to imperialism. They said they were targeting Gaddafi's military forces. They ignored the 33 children, 32 women, and 20 men who I saw buried in the small and traditional port town of Majer in Zlitan in early August. They said on August 20th or the 21st that Tripoli fell without resistance. But they didn't tell us that in 12 hours alone, 1,300 people were massacred in that city and 900 were injured. They said that Tripoli fell without resistance and that Saif al-Islam had been arrested and captured and that Gaddafi's compound, Bab al-Ziza, was taken by the rebels. But despite that, Saif al-Islam himself showed up in the hotel where I was trapped and took a group of journalists outside to see with their very own eyes. They didn't show us the thousands of people filling Bab al-Ziza and the streets of Tripoli waving the green flag on the night of August the 22nd. They said that Tripoli fell without resistance. But they didn't show us that in the 24 hours after those journalists from all the West major networks had seen that sight, that Bab al-Ziza alone was pounded 63 times with NATO bombs. They didn't show us how all the gatherings of the people to defend their capital from those who wished to send them back to the times of colonial puppet King Idris were attacked with missiles and Apache gunships. They didn't show us how the brave people of Abu Slim, the poorest area in Tripoli, and the staunchest area of support for Gaddafi, resisted for 5 days until on August 24th, NATO attacked anything that moved and piles of bodies lined the streets. They told us that the country was liberated. 6 weeks later, the rebels have conceded that they won't be able to move their headquarters to the capital. And that the rebels have confirmed, I think it was today, that they won't be able to take Beni Wali and Sirte also remain strong. So, Gaddafi, mass murderer, hated by his people so much that they would beg NATO to bomb their own country, hated so much that the capital city fell without resistance. Or NATO, mass murderer, killing the Libyan masses, because they would die for their leader, just like in Tripoli. I know which one we have mountains of evidence for. In fact, there is so much evidence that even the Conservative Party's own mouthpiece, The Telegraph, has been unable to hide from it. Amongst their numerous reports showing that the rebels lack the popular support that Gaddafi enjoys, one article published this week reported what I heard throughout my stay in Tripoli. A resident of Sirte, Susan Farjan, said, "We lived in democracy under Muammar Gaddafi. He was not a dictator. I lived in freedom. Libyan women had full human rights. It isn't that we need Muammar Gaddafi again, but we want to live just as we did before." In the same article, 80-year-old Mabuka says, "Life was good under Gaddafi. We were never afraid." Again, in the same article, another elderly lady says, "They are killing our children. Why are they doing this? For what? Life was good before." And yet another says, "Everyone loves Gaddafi, and we love him because we love Libya. Now the rebels have taken over. We might have to accept that. But Muammar will always be in our hearts." The spectacular U-turn of Al Jazeera from being a somewhat critical voice of imperialism's wars of aggression in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Palestine to being an open facilitator of the same aggression against Libya, Syria, and even now the progressive nations of Latin America was perhaps the greatest propaganda trick I have seen in my lifetime. Co-opting the support of their faithful Arab viewers in the West, whose voices garnered particular prominence during the fashionable so-called Arab Spring, was an important move in order to get all progressive circles in the West to join in the essential criminalization of Gaddafi, when those very circles should have, in contrast, been elevating the status of the not-so-fashionable Libyan Jamahiriya and learning from it. Now all cards are on the table. Al Jazeera's Director General Wadab Hanfar has resigned following the release of WikiLeaks cables, which revealed he has been taking orders from none other than the CIA. He has been replaced by a member of the Qatari royal family, which has been heavily engaged in the war against its fellow Arab brothers and sisters in Libya. But despite the role of Al Jazeera being clear as day now, it continues to get away with the same tricks of tugging on the liberal heartstrings of westernized audiences with its stories about how people in sovereign states of the global south's greatest tragedy is their lack of Western democracy, never mind that it has failed in the West. But despite the Al Jazeera's interest in championing this ideology is obviously straightforward. It hosts the United States' largest military base in the Middle East, CENTCOM, and they are, of course, close friends. Leaving the Rixos Hotel, where I had been trapped for 5 days, was the most surreal and probably the worst day of my life. It was a bad day. The safe, secure, welcoming city, full of life and warmth, that I had driven through days previously had transformed. Without seeing guns or heavy weaponry. Many people had gone into hiding, been killed, and thousands of others had fled. And the people that I knew who remained, who had been the very people who had helped me to learn about the glorious recent history of Gaddafi's Libya, were inevitably traumatized and in a complete state of shock. Libya reached the point, as Dan said, of having the highest standard of living in Africa, a high level of literacy, universal healthcare and free university education, a high status for women in society, and the greatest degree of equality for the large black population in the whole of North Africa and the Middle East. Those 40 years of revolutionary achievements have now been reversed. And for what? A year ago, after crippling wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and with the growing economic crisis of the imperialist nations, it seemed a remote possibility that the West would have the capacity to embark on another costly and embarrassing war. It seemed that the hegemony of the West was rapidly on its way out. But as Gaddafi's close brother Hugo Chavez said in his recent letter to the United Nations General Assembly, "Right now there is a very serious threat to global peace," he said. a new cycle of colonial wars which started in Libya with the sinister objective of refreshing the capitalist global system. End quote. He knows that his country will be targeted in that cycle with the very same model that they used against Libya and are now using against Syria. In the absence of an effective anti-imperialist media that can challenge and preempt the tricks of imperialism through its global media, it is the role of all progressive people to champion the sovereign states of the global south, who, like Libya and Syria, are a thorn in the side of the West. Otherwise, they will be picked off one by one to add fuel to the dying fire of imperialism. And on that note, I want to end with my wholehearted thanks to the heroic Green Libyan resistance, which continues to amaze the world in their ability to stave off the world's most powerful military machine. As Gaddafi said, not only are they defending Libya, but also Syria, Iran, Algeria, the African continent, and the entire global south. Thank you.
That opened a lot of eyes on that one because like
she was there. She should know.
but Al Jazeera is like, you know, is a puppet, and
yeah.
We didn't know that.
I suspected.
Well, I guess we have to suspect that that this is part of the deal.
Clinton is in Libya to offer a new aid package. Don't take it, guys.
You know, Obama administration offered millions of dollars in new aid to Libya as Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton encouraged the country's unsteady new leadership to commit to a democratic future free of retribution and acknowledged in unusually blunt terms that the United States would like to see former dictator Muammar Gaddafi dead. I mean, after you just heard that most of the country wants him as the leader. We hope we can be captured or killed. He can be captured or killed soon so that you don't have to fear him any longer, Clinton told students and others in a town hall gathering in the capital city. So it's kind of.
I can't imagine that was received very well.
No, but, you know.
They don't report that.
Now that we understand this is a big propaganda push, okay, this is what's going on. Let's see. Until now, the U.S. Has generally avoided saying that Gaddafi should be killed. U.S. officials usually say they want to see him brought to justice, something Clinton also said during her long visit, her day-long visit. I'm proud to stand here on the soil of free Libya, Clinton said, and the United States was proud to stand for you in your fight for freedom, and we will continue to stand with you as you continue this journey. That sounds like her. We met with the leader of Libya's Transitional National Council and offered about $11 million in additional aid, a fresh aid boost at Washington's contribution since the uprising since Gaddafi began in February to roughly $135 million. Where are we getting all this money, by the way?
They print it.
We're broke.
They print it and they just give it to
them. They give it to them, you know.
Yeah.
And the new aid package includes medical aid for wounded fighters and additional assistance to secure weaponry and any fear could fall into the hands of terrorists. Aid said the money is meant partly as a pledge to ongoing U.S. support during what is a difficult passage to free elections and new government after four decades of dictatorship. Now the hard part begins, Clinton said. Well, this is the New York Times, so you're going to hear a lot of crap. But, you know, it's really pretty disgusting that, you know, that this is the nature of what's going on, you know. What do you say? So let's move on. Not worry. This is another nightmare. In fact, if you can, you know.
Well, that's quite a picture of Obama there. Go back to that.
No, it's just a picture of him. He's smoking a cigarette.
And the French president,
yeah.
Nicolas Sarkozy's wife had a baby. Let's hope it doesn't look like him.
Mm. Well, anyway, police brutality, Times Square.
Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah, there's a lot of shouting and screaming. There's not much, but it's this is something that's quite. frightening when you think about it, that these damn New York police...
they were on horses.
They're on horseback, trampling over people.
Nice.
At Occupy. Nazis, because they were doing blood sacrifices and You know, they were doing all kinds of stuff, you know, satanic rituals and stuff. So that was well known. But there was Churchill, the real story was that Hitler got hold of the Spear of Destiny, okay, the Spear of Longinus, and, you know, was doing sacrifices, was offering blood sacrifices to that. And this was known, and they were trying, and Churchill brought in a whole bunch of cultists and everybody else to try to figure out what he was doing, because he was winning, right?
Yeah.
And they wanted to know how to stop this, so they had to. So that was one of the main reasons. So blaming Churchill on that, I don't know, yeah, maybe, but he did save England, and you know, so for that, I guess he has to be remembered. No.
Yep.
He may have accepted the bribes to hook up Zionism, but Truman took a $2 million bribe to do the same thing, to recognize them. So you know, before he left office. So that, you know, you have to kind of sometimes you got to question these
yeah.
especially Henry Mankow, who's
you've already said that's a bit sketchy.
Yeah. But he, you know,
well, take it and see what you think, folks. You don't have to,
you know,
you don't have to run with it. Just listen.
Yep. So, anyway, that's something. This is a little article. If anybody who's been following Herman McCain, all right?
No, not
the president.
Herman
Cain. Herman Cain. What did I say? McCain.
Yeah.
Yeah. Herman Cain.
The 999 guy.
Yeah. This is a little 5-minute report on him. All right. And it's the trouble with Herman Cain. Well, let's listen to this.
Hey, everybody, it's Tom Woods. I wanted to say a few words about GOP presidential candidate Herman Cain, who's attracted a lot of support, particularly Tea Party support, and has been called a Tea Party favorite. Now, I'm not singling him out because he's by any means the worst GOP presidential contender, but I'm at sort of a loss of other candidates to talk about. I mean, I could talk about Quiz Bowl champion Rick Santorum. I could talk about Tim Pawlenty, although what's there to say? I remember Sean Hannity actually saying before the first GOP debate, all eyes are on Tim Pawlenty. Well, speak for yourself, Sean. All eyes are on establishment bore Tim Pawlenty. You wish. Or Newt Gingrich, who has betrayed the free market and conservatism over and over and over again with his own stated principles. I could talk about Mitt Romney, but what is there to say? I mean, Mr. Plastic Man, what is there to say about Mitt Romney that hasn't already been said? And yet Herman Cain supported Mitt Romney for president in 2008. He looked at this plastic man who will say whatever he thinks the boobs want him to say to get elected, and Herman Cain thought, that's my man. That should, red flags ought to be going up right about there. Or how about TARP? He supported the whole bailout regime of 2008. He told us this was good economics. We got to get rid of all these free market purists, he called them. He said the Bush administration was giving us good information about the financial crisis, and so we needed this program. Well, at the end of this video, I'm going to share with you a resource page I've assembled where I can link to some articles that back up the things I'm saying. And I'm going to link you to David Stockman, formerly of the Reagan administration, and his own evaluation of TARP, which he more or less describes as one of the worst public policy atrocities of recent decades. Or then Afghanistan. We're told that Herman Cain can't tell us what his Afghanistan policy will be until he takes office. Well, you know, that's like a teensy-weensy bit of a problem there. Or what about the Patriot Act? We're told by Herman Cain that 90% of the Patriot Act is right on, and that the other 10% he can't actually delineate to us what that is, what provisions would be contained in that 10%, but don't worry, he's going to more or less side with the Patriot Act because given that 90% of it is good, we got to do what we got to do. Well, this is an offense against the Constitution. It's an offense against American traditions. And on my resource page, I'll link you to Bruce Fine, also of the Reagan administration, telling the truth about the Patriot Act. Or the economy. In 2005 and 6, we were told by Cain that there's no housing bubble. The media just made this up because it doesn't like Republicans. And as late as 2006 and then beyond, he's telling us that the economy's fine, you know, the statistics look great, this is just a media fabrication. this was what we got, and I personally think there are plenty of people like this in Washington already who are completely clueless about the condition of the economy, as practically all the candidates in 2008 even had been. And then finally, we can talk about the Federal Reserve. Herman Cain headed the Federal Reserve of Kansas City and has flip-flopped on the issue of whether the Fed ought to be audited, but he's argued that, well, there's no need to audit the Fed. You're not going to find anything. Well, that just goes to show he doesn't even understand the question. It's not like we're looking to audit the Fed to see if Ben Bernanke has been printing up money and using it to go on vacation in the Bahamas. The issue is there are a lot of unanswered questions that are very specific about how the Fed handled the financial crisis. We want answers to those questions, and we can get them with an audit. So in summary, why would we rush to support this guy whom we know very little about, and what we do know about him seems to run counter to what the Tea Party is supposed to be standing for, if they're not just going to be another flash in the pan, nothing. Why do we flock to this guy when we've got a man who's got a 30-year consistent track record, who has supported the ideas of freedom in good times and bad, regardless of what it has meant for his personal popularity? And that, of course, is Ron Paul. Now, for my resource page, where you can read more about these topics, check out tomwoods.com/Cain. And for more videos, make sure and subscribe to the channel.
That kind of tells you what's happening with Herman Cain.
Yeah. The others that he touched on, too.
Yeah, but Herman Cain is really, really
well, as
really
I said,
bad.
He says 999, I say 555.
Yeah.
And that's for the five-letter word sucks. His plan sucks, sucks, sucks.
I was going to go into this one, but I don't.
We can come back to it.
Yeah, it's how Britain's biggest racist created Zionism. And that would be interesting, I think, too.
Mm.
But let me just see here.
Doesn't take much.
Yeah. Okay. Well, forget that one.
Really, they took it down already, huh?
They
rip out any of these good ones.
Now I got one more that I know we're not reading a lot here tonight,
yeah.
But there are so many of these incredible good pieces that
came
this
up. Is by Chris Hedges.
And it says, and this one could take them all down. He states, and Hedges mm-hmm. has been great. We played a couple of his pieces
mm-hmm.
recently, and he's just been a really, he understands this Occupy Wall Street, and he's been a very good spokesman, and I think an independent spokesman. And,
mm-hmm.
and I'd like to play this. This is Christopher Hedges. This one could take them all down. October 15th, Golden Day of Action, Times Square, New York City.
I'm Chris Hedges. I'm a writer. I write books. I spent 20 years overseas as a war correspondent. Came back and realized that corporations had carried out a coup d'etat in my country. And I've been fighting back, although not as effectively as you guys. Well, I've covered movement. I covered all of the revolutions in Eastern Europe. I covered the street demonstrations that brought down Milosevic. I covered both the Palestinian intifadas. And once movements like this start and articulate a fundamental truth about the society that they live in and expose the repression, the mendacity, the corruption, and the decay of the structures of power, then they have a kind of centrifugal force. You never know where they're going. I was with the leaders of the movement, the opposition movement in East Germany in Leipzig on the afternoon of November 9th, 1989, and they said that perhaps within a year there would be free passage back and forth across the Berlin Wall. In a few hours, the Berlin Wall didn't exist. What happens is, in all of these movements, this was true in Prague as well, is that the foot soldiers of the elite, the blue uniform police, the mechanisms of control, finally don't want to impede the movement. And at that point, the power elite is left defenseless. So where is it going? No one knows. Even the people most intimately involved in the organization don't know. They have just with all of these movements take on a kind of life and color that is in some ways finally mysterious. The only thing I can say, having been in the middle of similar movements, is that this one is real, and this one could take them all down.
You had to get your mind.
Well, let me first say I learned a lot more from the people who are occupying than my critique of the corporate state, I think, coalesces with the critique that many people in Occupy Wall Street have. But I never wrote in any of my books about how to bring them down. This whole non-hierarchical structure is really brilliant. And I didn't have a clue. I didn't have a clue. Because they can't destroy the movement like that. The fact that you rotate people through positions of leadership, and the fact that you're completely transparent, the fact that you realize that, you've clearly been provoked. I mean, Anthony Bologna was, trying to provoke people in that crowd because they want windows smashed. What they know how to handle that, they don't know how to handle it. This is driving them insane. And the fact is that I can guarantee you that huge segments of those blue uniform police sympathize with everything that you're doing. And that is the way you can shatter the manacles of control that have been placed on the country by the corporate state. And that's what scares them. I mean, the most aggressive figures in the crowds are these white-shirted assholes. Always remember that you only have to deal with them, once in a while. These poor uniform cops got to deal with them every day. I think the movement's really, 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 really smart, really astute, and I don't really think I have much to teach it at all. I don't think there's any danger of this movement being seduced or co-opted by MoveOn.org, which is a reprehensible organization, or the Democratic Party, or anyone else, or the Teamsters. The fact is, what you've done, what they have not done, which is fight back. And because you've fought back, they've been exposed for who they are, i.e. the leaders of these groups. That's why they're running to you and attempting to restore what little shredded credibility they have left. You know, I'm a visitor. I come and go. But I don't sense that there's any danger. I think the sort of political consciousness of this group is so high that they see through all of these figures who show up the park. I mean, I was there when Patterson showed up, Charlie Rangel showed up. It's sort of almost sad in a way. Because the fact is they have offered nothing, done nothing, except, of course, Mao, this empty rhetoric, this kind of feel-your-pain language while betraying the very people they purportedly represent. So I don't think there's any danger of this movement being co-opted at all. I think that even with the Teamsters, the union bosses, and these union bosses are pulling down five times what the rank and file is pulling down, they've done nothing for unions except basically barter away their benefits and rights. And in fact, the union bosses have to get down here because otherwise they're going to lose their rank and file. That's why you're seeing groups like MoveOn or Teamsters coming down here, because you do what their leadership has not done, which is stand up. And let me just say something. I wasn't here Friday morning. For me, I got kids, and it's not about me anymore. It's about the next generation. It's about my children's generation. And I think my passion for what you're doing, and I would even use the word love, comes from the fact that I look at you as fighting on behalf of, like, my little 3-year-old. And when I on Friday morning, of course I was up to find out what happened, and I did what I do now, which is start crying. God bless you all.
Check out occupytv.org, okay? You can get some of these videos. That was a very good one, by the way. Very, very good. So I just wanted to reiterate that. This is kind of interesting. This one was about several hundred residents, okay, of Zugdidi.
What is that?
This is in Zugdidi. Several hundred residents of the city of Zugdidi, western Georgia, rallied outside the Lazika Bank today, demanding the punishment of bank officers who embezzled bank funds in their name.
Wow. Right? Reporting several officers of the bank issued bank loans in the names of about 400 residents of the city, including pensioners and disabled persons. By tricking them into signing some documents based upon which they issued loans and embezzled the money, the cheated residents of the same city said the bank has begun to seize and sell their property by auction following the swindle.
One
credit officer of the bank and his accomplice have already been arrested by the police. Well, how do they have the right to sell their property?
I know. It's amazing, isn't it?
Where is it?
What?
What town?
Zugdidi, western Georgia.
Oh.
Yeah, Zugdidi, western
Georgia. Called outside the Lazika Bank. Oh, boy.
Yeah. That's a very short article.
In Central Europe somewhere.
It's in western Georgia. No, I think it's in western Georgia of the United States.
I don't think so. If you go back there.
Oh, really?
Go back.
That
article.
Zugdidi? Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Maybe in Georgia, the country? Yeah, maybe it is. It's in. Those sectors says Caucasus.
Vestavia.
All the economies, yeah. And what did you say? Vestavia?
Vestavia.
Vestavia. No, that's just the name
of the name of the paper.
Whatever. I don't know what that is.
Yeah, I don't think
Western Georgia is the country. Georgia, which is outside of that's the whole thing. So this is in western Georgia. I thought it was Georgia, but it's western Georgia.
No, I tried to tell you that.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you for clearing that up.
I'm sure when some bankers here get wind of it, they'll try the same thing if it's something they haven't done. That's
unbelievable. Bankers are such crooks.
They really are.
Jesus, unbelievable.
The godfathers.
I would play this, but the problem with these is that I haven't played much on this stuff, and because it's been so all over the place, and the Fukushima rainfall in St. Louis, Missouri, all over the country, the rainfall is radioactive, and we're getting high levels of it everywhere. I saw a little video the other day on a guy putting a Geiger counter in a grocery store over the produce.
Oh God!
And the Geiger counter was going crazy. It was going from it was going everywhere. All the produce was radioactive.
Oh dear!
You take a Stop and Shop or something.
Yeah.
A huge produce section. He put things all over, and they were all different high levels of radiation. And it was registered. It's amazing. So it's hard to talk about this in any fact because it's everywhere. You know, it's just everywhere. We're getting killed.
Yeah.
it's hard to play these because they're so poorly done, but they're showing.
Nonetheless, the water
that,
is radioactive.
Oh, yeah.
That's being coming rain down on us.
Oh, absolutely. It's really unbelievable. The fraud at the heart of student lending exposed. One sentence everyone should read.
Oh.
Because of, as Bloomberg reported last night, we now have a prima facie evidence that the student loan market is not only an epic bubble, but it is also the next subprime. To wit, Vince Sampson, President, Education Finance Council, said during a panel at the Eastern Conference in Miami Monday that lenders are no longer pushing loans to people who can't afford them.
Oh, okay.
Well, you got hundreds and maybe a million students out there who have student loans that have no jobs to pay them off.
And no prospect of
and
ever
no
getting
And no prospect
one.
Of getting a job to pay
ever.
Them off. Yeah. So reread the last sentence as many times as possible and necessary for it to sink in. Meaning, lenders are no longer pushing loans to people who can't afford them. Okay, interesting. Just like before, lenders were pushing loans to people who can't afford them, which became the reason for the subprime bubble, which has since spread to prime, but was missing the actual confirmation from authorities of just this action. This time around, we have actual confirmation that student loans are being actually peddled to people who cannot afford them. And with the government a primary source of lending, we will be lucky if tears is all this ends in, right? So, in other words, it's a huge, huge, huge mess.
And they're never going to get jobs.
So they're never going to get paid. And these student loans, you can't rub off by bankruptcy.
Nope.
Which is, you know, not right, I don't think. You would think that they would be able to get rid of these.
Nope.
A key reason... a key reason why a preponderance of the population is fascinated with the student loan market is that, as USA Today reported in a landmark piece last year, it is now bigger than ever the credit card market. Bigger than ever. It is now bigger than ever the credit card market.
It's probably bigger than the credit card market ever was.
That's a weird way to say it. And as the monthly consumer debt update from the Fed reminds us, the primary source of funding is none other than the U.S. government. To many, this market has become the biggest credit bubble in America. Why do we make a big deal out of this? Because the Bloomberg reported last night, we now have prima facie evidence that the student loan market is not only an epic bubble, but it is also the next subprime to wit. And I just went in this, said this. Vince, President of Education, said during a panel, the bubble is the sector in the sector is over. Noted political dynamic of the education funding. U.S. is currently 16th in the world in degree of attainment. He noted that the U.S. Education Secretary and U.S. President have probably looked at that number. Nevertheless, the state universities are struggling because state governments are poorer. And Samson says a sustained effort is underway at some schools to bring in out-of-state tuition, which typically pay 100% of the cost.
We're 16th in what? I didn't understand that.
I must be 16th in the world in degree attainment. So,
we're
the U.S.
falling.
The U.S. is 16th country in the world of the number of people who are getting degrees.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty bad for us, for who we are supposed to be. Everybody's going after borrowers with cosigners and high FICOs. Also students who may be going to the better schools. And Gary Santo, an MD at First Barberhead, said during the panel that borrowers, too, are being more conservative in their choice of education funding. And Lambot said Moody's outlook on private student loan market is negative, but newer loans should perform better. To be sure, the implications of the $850 billion student loan bubble, $850 billion student loan bubble, blowing up spread through the financial markets, and it will make subprime seem like a tame walk in the park. Of course, nobody will care about it until it's too late, just like every other time, because this time is never different. So anyway, get ready for the student loan bubble to go boom, $850 billion. Holy crap!
Well, with the cost of tuition, $50,000 or $60,000 a year, you know.
Well, the guys are taking out $100,000. You know,
Leo. By the time you pay for your tuition, your room and board, and everything else,
about $50,000. You know, $50,000.
It costs almost that to go to Hotchkiss up the street. That's high school.
That's true. I don't know.
It's a lot of money.
Yeah. So, Obama bails out
GM salmon firm.
The Obama administration awarded a coveted research grant to a financially strapped company working to put genetically modified salmon on America's dinner table, overlooking disclosures that the firm could run out of cash in early 2012.
That's sort of like try to fund the solar panel.
That's right.
You know, it must be owned by a buddy.
Probably. Campaigners said the $500,000 grant to Aquabody Bounty amounts to a bailout for the firm's main investor, the business tycoon and former economics minister of Georgia, Kaka Benduzzi. They are also comparing it to Solyndra, this controversy, which saw a solar company go bankrupt after receiving government loan guarantees. Well, certainly this does have shades of Solyndra. We have seen this company stock plummeting for months and months, years actually. And what does the U.S. Department of Agriculture do but gives this company money? The policy analyst for the Center for Food Safety, which imposes GM salmon.
Yeah, I don't want genetically modified salmon either.
No, I mean,
what's wrong with this man?
Obama is one sick sucker.
Yeah.
And this has to be reported in the Guardian, you know, instead of an American newspaper. The Guardian is a British newspaper.
Yeah.
This
is a research firm, research that any public university or independent institution could be doing. So why is USA funding this interested company to do it?
The grant award last month
came at a critical juncture for Aquabounty. After $67 million in 16 years waiting, the Food and Drug Administration could pronounce GM salmon fit for human consumption within weeks, the company's executive Ron Stofish said. Based on what we are seeing, we believe we have all the approval by the end of the year, but we plan for all contingencies, he said. He said the company had prospective fish farmers lined up for the GM salmon in South Dakota, West Virginia, Wisconsin, and Ohio. We have people in the United States who are interested in growing these fish right now. If approved, the salmon would be the first modified animal to make its way into the food chain, clearing the way for an entire menagerie of redesigns from fast-growing trout, tilapia, to the EnviroPig, genetically altered to produce less polluting poo. The USDA said it followed the proper procedures in making the grant from the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, including a review of Aquabounty's financial information. On this particular grant, and blah, blah, blah.
Procedures did call for the company to submit 2 years, blah, 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 yeah. So she said that NIFA reviewed 58 biotech research proposals before announcing the grant for Aquabounty.
GM salmon, originally devised by researchers of Newfoundland's Memorial University, combined a growth hormone gene from Chinook salmon, the largest variety in the Pacific, with a strip of DNA from the ocean pout, an eel-like animal that lives in extremely cold water. Normally, the gene ensures the pout does not freeze to death. In the case of the GM salmon, it ensures the growth hormone gene is switched on continuously for nonstop growth spurts. The GM salmon grow up to six times as fast as the conventional variety. The company plans to grow the modified salmon eggs at a lab in Prince Edward Island and then fly them to Panama, where they'll be raised in inland fish farms. They would then be shipped back for sale in the U.S. I think this sounds costly.
not only costly, it's damn right sick.
The use of inland fish farms is designed to prevent the salmon from escaping into the wild. The company says 98% of the fish are sterile. However, the Canadian government has admitted it cannot fully protect wild fish stocks in Canada from GM salmon. And in Alaska, senators introduced bills on Monday to ban the salmon shipment in the U.S. of GM salmon, citing risks to salmon in the wild. The grant to Aqua Bounty, through just a fraction of the $500 million loan guarantee to the bankrupt solar company, comes at a time when the Obama administration is on the defensive when it comes to its handling of energy and environmental projects.
So,
and the article goes on.
So anyway,
you get the drift.
Yeah, I mean, why would you want, it's just downright sick.
Mm. I don't think we should be screwing with nature that way.
I don't think so, Lila. I don't think so at all. And, we're in serious trouble with this stuff. I want to share this on my Facebook account so that people see it. It's something like Obama. So we got about a few minutes left here, and I want to just see what. There's so many things. There's just so much that I didn't. Everybody knows that Italy and Greece and everywhere else is really getting out of hand. Pakistan deploys troops along the Afghanistan border.
We'll have no need to call the road when we get to me and old dog Frey to do the time away. If we don't pull a perch up back, we'll pull our toes in gilly grass, or else pull up a weed and chaw and maybe seven jaw. And meet me at the fishing hole. I can't think of a better way to pass the time of day.
That was very cute. Thank you.
Good
night, folks.
Yeah, that's great. And I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight. And I hope you have a. Please join us again tomorrow night, right here, for our Al Bielek tribute and with Preston Nichols. Peter Moon and George Dixon and Lila and myself.
Okay, good night.
All right.